This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Thank you very much. Thanks for coming. And we're very pleased to welcome Gayatri here. She's been at Penn on and off, and she spent some time here, but I think the first time she comes to Slot. And we wanted to use the pretext of the MLA as a way of thinking and really improvising a dialogue. And Eduardo has been here as well, and we've found out that it's much better to improvise and not really have more than a question to start from. And clearly, the first question we wanted to discuss was something that could be phrased in those terms: how can we mourn Jacques Derrida? And given the scandalous reaction of certain newspapers and the press, and so that's my question to both of you, since after all, the MLA, the PMLA, is doing a sort of survey on what's the legacy of Derrida, what's the legacy of deconstruction. And I would suggest going back to this Freudian couple of mourning and melancholia, beyond that very possibility of mourning Jacques Derrida, are we not perhaps in a certain melancholia for an age that might be that of the work of mourning? I'm alluding to this book by Derrida, in which he, as you may know, has a series of eulogies for people like Lacan, for Althusser, Foucault, Barthes, Louis Marin, Deleuze, Lévinas, Lyotard. And for those among us who knew Jacques Derrida, there was indeed this sense that he felt very keenly that he was the last of a certain generation. So do we have a sense of nostalgia and an endless melancholia for that age? And if so, can we name it? Is it something that we could put words on? Is it an important process? How to do? And clearly, since we had the question of politics, I think somehow this is really linked to what has appeared in the more and more obvious in the last decade, that Derrida's work became more and more both political and religious at the same time, which poses another kind of problem. So this is the question I'd like to start with, and I don't know who.
Okay, well, I'd like to begin just by thanking Aaron and Jean-Michel for inviting us to be here, and thanking all of you for being here as well. Actually, all three of us, I think, have participated in different memorials for Derrida in October and November, I think. And I think that if one returns to Freud, the after Freud, this necessity of considering the intellectual and political genealogy of loss and mourning through melancholy, I would agree with you, Jean-Michel, that we would be closer to a kind of melancholic period than a mournful period in relation to Derrida, only because, at least initially, the initial conception of mourning within the essay, within Freud's essay, from what I remember, has to do with the eventual withdrawal of the libido from the lost object. And I think that Derrida, who often wrote on mourning, not only in the memorials that he wrote, but also in Spectres of Marx and other texts as well, and the texts on Demand also. I think he very often talked about what he called impossible mourning. And this impossible mourning would be closer to the endlessness of mourning that Freud identifies with melancholy. I would say, I mean, just to be short, and then we can elaborate this together, that at some level, to mourn Derrida would involve, among other things, both remaining faithful and unfaithful to his work in some way. And what I mean by that is that one should carry on the multiple legacies of his work, and I think often, and not just once, he very often said that there's no such thing as a unique affiliation, no such thing as a unique legacy, that every legacy and every affiliation is always multiple. So that when we think of the legacies of Derrida, or when we think of mourning Derrida, one of the things I think that we have to broach are the multiple threads of his work. And I think that the way in which one remains faithful to his work was always at some level to take it, mobilize it in a different context, and move it somewhere else, which was what he did in relation to the text that he read. And I would say that activity of reading, reinterpreting, moving his text in another direction belongs to what I would call mourning. I mean, mourning redefined as something like reading his text historically within different contexts and trying to move them in other directions. But those are just preliminary remarks. You can add to them.
So I have the mic here, right?
Yes.
Again, I'll echo Eduardo, and I'll thank you all for coming. Eduardo, you will agree, however, that in a certain sense, it's too soon to know how to mourn Derrida. Mm-hmm. Eduard, you, I see Helen in the audience. We actually engaged in one of these memorials very soon after his death. I was at the burial. I think also, I don't want to make too much of it, but in a very significant sense, well, Carol Jacobs is here, and she was at on the occasion when I was trying to be, as you were there too, as careful as possible with Derrida there in terms of what it was that, how I had been touched by deconstruction, yes? And the best I could do was to say that I felt in some way that it was like Lacan's definition of the subject in the field of vision. I was a touch, I was a stain in the field of deconstruction, so that my part in that nostalgia or my part in a Freudian scenario of mourning is necessarily somewhat oblique. And you will remember with infinite sweetness Derrida turned it around in his response. And on the other hand, he did not contradict that obliqueness. He said, actually, in the French language, the word tâche has another meaning. You are the task of deconstruction, he said. So to an extent, the entire field of knowing how to mourn, for which you have to be within a certain kind of performative set of conventions. In the larger context, one doesn't know how to mourn anyway. Mourning happens. But in a very precise sense, in my own daily thinking of how it was that he made my thinking life, I mean, as I've said many, many times, when I first read him, I did not know his name. So I did not know what I was reading. So to an extent, I'm bewildered about how to mourn him. I don't know. And what is mourning anyway? Is it a private act of coming to terms with a loss, which, you know, is a way of describing what we read in Freud? Or when we talk about politics of mourning or the conventions of mourning, is it possible, in fact, to mourn in public? Remember, we've been reading Voyou together, and Derrida brings to mind the fact that Pascal and others have spoken about the fact that it is in the public domain that a certain irony is made possible by democracy. So what is it to mourn in public? So I have no answer to these questions. I will, however, say something that some of you, because again, there are co-mourners in this group, including you, Helen, and so on, and in fact, this is just out in Radical Philosophy, I will repeat myself. When Derrida was discussing that book Columbia, he mentioned that you can neither execute nor mourn without an intuition of transcendence. And we know very well what he thought about the death penalty. His position there was absolutely uncomplicated. It was a no. So that intuition of transcendence, he put aside. And it seemed to me when at the burial at that municipal cemetery, with absolutely no presence of anything religious, and also a request for no public speeches, and those anodyne words read by his son, which could not be, about which we have to think twice, that it was indeed a valediction forbidding mourning. So that, I don't want to go on about this, because we ought to talk about other things, but I have many things to say about Derrida's supposed turn to religion. It's not something that I will just let pass. Right. Indeed, he was concerned profoundly about religion, with religion, and thought about it. But on the other hand, turn to religion, I think I have something to say about that. But I'll stop here. And this is not a satisfactory answer, because the answer is either it's too soon for me to know, or I don't know.
Right. I agree. I mean, I completely agree with this caveat that this so-called turn to religion in the later years was perhaps a way of thinking along the same lines with slightly different vocabulary. I was thinking of this because, after all, as you just suggested, Gayatri, in order to mourn, you have to be sure that you're alive, and one is never sure that one is alive. And I think this is something that Derrida complicated for us. I was thinking, being just back from Paris, that among the people he wrote all these beautiful eulogies for, there's somebody who I thought had died and is still alive from this generation, and is not often associated with Derrida, but I think was really one of those who brought Derrida here, is René Girard.
Yes.
Who's still alive and kicking and publishing, and obviously he's somebody, yes, he's somebody who has chosen this turn to religion with a vengeance, and I think, I don't think there's much in common between what Derrida has done and René Girard in the last 10 years, but I think precisely this would be a case where the deconstruction of religion would be necessary. I'm referring, of course, to the biographical fact that Girard was one of the organizers of this Baltimore meeting in 66. So it was interesting. There was a little shock that I saw a recent book by René Girard going back and accusing structuralism as being a perversion and so on, and that everything was in the Bible, and as we know from René Girard. But that poses this question of, since we don't know, do we need to pluralize everything, like you spoke of legacies in a plural, strategies, mournings in a plural, in a way, what to do next? Well, that would be my other question. Is there something we can do? This is why the politics, I think, of the question somehow forces us to think of agency, maybe, or at least the conditions of possibility of some kind of agency.
I would come at it maybe by returning to something that Gayatri said, and then maybe come at it through another route. But I just wanted to return to your statement, this question about whether or not grief is something that is private, whether it's something that one experiences in solitude. Very often people, when they think about grief in that way, they think about grief as something that depoliticizes in a certain way. And I think that the alternate way to look at it is with grief, I mean, we all have experienced loss, and I think that grief, among other things, tells us something about ourselves. I mean, when we experience loss, when we experience grief, when we mourn something that we have lost, somebody we have lost, when we reveal in that way that we've been touched by somebody else, one of the things that grief tells us, among other things, is that we are related to others. You know, that there's a way in which in advance we are related to others, we're bound to others, we're tied to others, and this relationality is something that both makes us who we are the ones who are related to others, but also dispossesses us in some way, since it's precisely because of our relations to others that we're never simply just ourselves. So it seems to me that if you begin to think of what we can learn from grief and mourning, and I think one of those things would be this relationality, which Derrida very often talked about in terms of the trace of the other in us. And that trace of the other in us, something that is in us but exceeds us at the same time, is a way to, I think, begin to broach in a different way, perhaps, than you might have done, Gachi, I'm not sure, this issue of transcendence, right? Because I think that when Derrida talks about transcendence, he very often marks it in a certain way so that it's a finite transcendence. And I've always understood that as a signal in this context, the relationship that we have with others, this other that bears, leaves its trace in us. From the very first moment that we're touched by them, moved by them, we're inhabited by them in some way. And that trace of the other in us is both in us and outside us at the same time. And so in us and transcending us in some way. And so it seems to me that if you begin to think about what you can learn from grief, and if one of the things that grief tells us is that we're related to others and that this relation both constitutes us and dispossesses us in some way, then this question of how you organize a political community around that becomes very difficult, I think, so that the question of agency becomes more complicated. And I think that while there are certain contexts in which, of course, we want to think of ourselves as bounded in some way, when we claim rights for ourselves or for others, when in legal contexts, we want to think of ourselves as kind of bounded, defined in some way, it's perhaps a mistake to think that description of us, that description that we need to use when we are in those contexts, is an adequate description of who we are, right? Since who we are involves these relations to others, which both, again, constitute us and deconstitute us. So that, I guess I was trying to trace a kind of thread through some of the terms that Gachi was evoking, and in that way return to not just the need to reconceptualize agency in terms of this autonomy and dependency that seems to be at work, but also to, in that way, rethink politics in some way. And I just close maybe these comments with this, because I, of course, like Gachi saying that she doesn't yet know if the timing is right, if we can mourn already, but also what would it mean to mourn? And I think mourning always has some relation to something that we don't know. I mean, when we mourn the other, one of the things that Freud says is that when we experience that loss, there's something that we don't yet know about what we have lost in the other. Right? There's something that remains hidden in the loss in some way. And I would try and extend that uncertainty into the domain of politics in some way. And one of the things that I've often thought about, and I do this very often with students, is try and get them to think about what a politics would look like if it were modeled on tears in some way. And you know, they kind of look at you, well, what do you mean, model on tears? But you know, if you think about it, when we think about acting politically, we always think about looking at a situation, evaluating it, and then on the basis of that evaluation, deciding which way to go, which way to act. So that at some level, acting politically depends on seeing something. It depends on something visual. But when you have tears in your eyes, you can't see things clearly. Right? So a politics based on the model of the tear is a politics that begins in the presupposition that you always act without seeing things clearly, that you always act with tears in your eyes. And of course, when you're witnessing somebody crying, you're witnessing that self melt. Right? You're seeing the self melt in some way. And I think that dissolution of the self, that figure of the dissolution of the self, is something that would be linked to this the consequences of our being inscribed in relation to others. which I think has that dissolving effect, even though at the same time it becomes the means toward our being able to define who we are in some way.
I'm going to say something about grief, which may be just a little bit different. Eh? Mm-hmm. I think, first of all, of course, one distinguishes between grief and mourning.
Yes.
Mourning is the work.
Right.
And it happens. I mean, the reason why I said it was too soon was because perhaps in a certain sense it's always too soon to know if one has mourned. Mm-hmm. Because if it matters, mm-hmm. if it matters, then the countersignature of the other person is not there in different ways. Mm-hmm. So, but grief also makes one sense a solitude. I would like to say that, I'm not a religious person. But what is it to say one is not a religious person? Eh? If you think about the beginning of Aporias, Derrida says something there which is quite obviously true. So I will repeat that all cultures are cultures of death. Mm-hmm. Now, therefore, in the sense in which my cultural production is a different culture of death, where you burn, where you make sure that, it seems brutal to Christians, you make sure that the skull burns well, you have an action which tells you that mourning is over, and I hear that my piece on Edward in Critical Inquiry is out. Right at the end, I invoke it's not a prayer, it's simply a bit of speech from the scriptures before Hinduism turned into the kind of stuff that we know today, when it was more like an aboriginal kind of nature thing, right? Where it says, as the ripe fruit bursts its skin, and presumably the seed falls to the ground, so does immortality burst out of death. Pushing up the daisies, I said in the thing, right? Now this notion of, which is why the forbidding of mourning spoke to me, this notion of stopping mourning is very different from the elaborate extravagance of the peoples of the book, and which then different sort of, slightly, if you will forgive me saying this, it's more constipated extravagance in the sort of Protestant tradition. I remember Derrida saying to me, to my great horror, at Demands, that huge meal at the old Heidelberg or whatever it was called, these people don't know how to mourn, because of course everyone was just completely proper and okay and talking and drinking champagne and so on and so forth. So to an extent, the fact that the mourning is a set of performative conventions, and again quoting Derrida, the event of mourning is what escapes those conventions. One cannot just endlessly talk about Freud. Mm-hmm. See what I mean?
Yeah.
So in fact, what happens to us when grief hits us is also written rather than some universal truth about human beings. That's to an extent, I think, therefore, we have to think about that without just pluralizing as a gesture of political correctness. The singularity is a repeatable difference, after all. So we mourn together, but we repeat our differences. And it also seems to me that in the sense, when we talk about agency, what do we do now? I'm trying to quote as much of Derrida as I can, because it seems to me that's also an act of remembering, isn't it? When in the Politics of Friendship, he talks about the madness of politics. What is that madness of politics? The madness of politics is being reasonable. That's the madness. Because you take the obvious commonsensical curvature between one speaker and another, courbure, mm-hmm. and you turn it into a droiture so that you can act, and that's madness. That's an incredible thing to say, that reason is something small that we must that produce, that we must nourish, that we must protect, because it is so, it's not our king, because it is so easily contravened. And so it seems to me that that setting to work, that keeping in mind that acting according to consistent and calculable principles, that's politics. And it's very fragile and it's mad, because the literal truth of things will not allow such a thing to actually go on. The madness is another name of consistent and reasonable and calculable behavior. It seems to me that that setting to work is something that really speaks very practically to what we must do if we think of a just world.
Yes, in that context, I was thinking of the way in which Derrida's thought in some cases was extremely practical. I've recently read a whole manuscript on the greffe and the foundation of the Collège International de Philosophie, which was basically Derrida's brainchild. And I think one could describe it, as Gayatri just did, in terms of a certain madness, because it's an institution that has no real space, no funding, that nobody knows what to do with right now, but that's quite unique, and tries to pose, and has been successful. I'm not sure how long it will survive, but it's trying, and poses the question very concretely of what is philosophy, what can it do, and how can one think differently through all sorts of practices, politics including. But maybe one other question, talking about this impossibility of mourning, and it's really something I'd like to have your personal take on, is having reread Work of Mourning, you feel that somehow facing a number of friends like Althusser and Derrida is really talking about the part of himself that died with the person who died. But there is one who I think has exerted maybe even more of an impact, which is Levinas. And this is this way in which it seems to me, and I'd like to have your opinion, maybe I'm just guessing too quickly, that with Levinas' death, Derrida could, in a way, both become Levinas and become Levinas differently. And I wonder whether this is something that is possible after his own death.
Jean-Michel, the idea of becoming Levinas differently is an intriguing idea, because everything hangs on that word differently. For the longest time, it really takes time reading Derrida. Because at first, I'm convinced he means something, mm-hmm. and then suddenly I read him again. I mean, this is not just true of Derrida. Of course, this is also true of a handful of other writers. But for the longest time, I thought that idea of the interruption of the epistemological by the ethical, the postponement and interruption, that was Derrida, just as I had thought that the Nietzschean notion of pushing the same, just pushing back the other, was Derrida. And then I read again carefully to see that Derrida is, in fact, commenting on this notion. And I think where you really get Derrida's becoming Levinas autrement, as it were, is otherwise than Levinas, as it were, is in Adieu, isn't it?
Right, exactly.
I mean, because the Levinas of whom he speaks in that early Violence and Metaphysics, there's a whole trajectory, and finally you come to Adieu, where you see that this is very peculiar, because of course these are topics that one would not think the great philosopher to be dwelling on. But the courage of that address a year later in the presence of relatives and so on and so forth, one of the things to take up was the Levinas's notion of reproductive heteronormativity and its place in his philosophy. The idea of the woman, not empirical, Levinas is careful, and then coming back to the father and so on. It's amazing that on that occasion Derrida talks about it. Then Derrida brings up that passage where Moses sees the backside of God. Okay, again, if one reads carefully, one would see that Derrida is taking a distance from this. And I think the most amazing part is where Derrida says that Levinas has been too silent, and I've said this before, too silent about the earthly Jerusalem, and has not attended to the fact that the state, which Derrida very carefully reads the idea of the third in that text, as you remember, and says that the third already implies a straight line to the state, and there is no allowance made for the difference between the narrow sense and the general sense. And so Levinas is obliged to be silent on the fact that the state of Israel is breaking the commandments. I'm almost paraphrasing Derrida's words. That seems to me to be an amazing text of solidarity and distancing. The only text that I can compare this to is Of Spirit, which has been completely misread by many people. But anyway, so yes, I agree. Derrida is very closely tied to Levinas. There are many things in Levinas that one can also see in Derrida. But I don't believe Levinas would be capable of asking the question that Derrida asks in Voyou: how many votes for the unconscious? You know, he's extremely careful about this business of citizenship, democracy as body count, and so on and so forth. That's where I find my Derrida, as it were, not just Levinas otherwise.
I think on this issue I agree that perhaps because Levinas himself had a more traditional political point of view, which was that of a French Jewishness struggle with a number of institutions and striving for a certain recognition, which had been given, I think there was more of a sort of moral timidity, maybe, in facing politics, whereas, of course, all the other questions are absolutely sharp. We know that with Derrida, the question of the political was literally everywhere.
I want to say something about what Gatti just said. Just as a kind of parenthesis, I'll just very briefly return to your evocation of the founding of the Collège, because you said that there was a kind of madness to the setting up of this institution, which was supposed to be not an institution, was not to be institutionalized in some way. It didn't have a center, it was sort of distributed, it was decentralized. But if you remember the proposal that he wrote for the Collège, which was, from what I understand, from what you told me, it was extremely painful to write because it had to be addressed to the Ministry of Education. There was a way in which, going back to what Gatri said, that the, sort of the madness has to do with the activity of trying to be reasonable, to set it up, and so on. There was a kind of madness in writing the proposal because it had to follow a certain kind of genre, which at times prevented him from signing the text in a double way. He had a very difficult time signing that particular text. But in regard to the comments about Levinas, actually, I too kind of bounced back when you said, you know, becoming Levinas, but differently. It reminded me actually about, there's a line in Emerson's journals after the death of his brother, Charles, who was his best friend. In different moments, he says things like, when Charles and I were talking, I couldn't tell who was generating what, whether my thoughts were mine or his. There was such an identification between the two of them. And at one point, he has this very beautiful formulation in one of his notebooks where he says, Charles was like no other, which is just fabulous, because on the one hand, Charles was like no other because he's absolutely singular, and at the same time, Charles is like no other because he's like me. Right? So there's this way in which that identification, but at the same time marking the singularity, is something that I would just emphasize in what Gatji was saying, there is a kind of closeness and intimacy that he actually, in his thesis defense, actually marks Levinas and Heidegger as people with whom he feels closest to in some way, precisely because there's a kind of loneliness to their work. But what I also wanted to say is that I also think that when we try and talk about the way in which he worked and the way in which he read different writers, there was always a sense that he inhabited the language of the one he was writing on, right? So that even in as early as Grammatology, you know, he says, well, in regard to reading Nietzsche, one has to surrender oneself to Nietzsche and go as far as one can with him until you hit a kind of wall or impasse and can't go any further with him. So there's a way in which at each moment he surrenders himself to the language of the one that he's writing on until he meets a kind of resistance. And I think that has something to do with the strategy of reading, which involves a kind of intimacy that at the same time marks a kind of difference and distance. But I think it has something to do with the strategy of reading as well.
But maybe in the case of Levinas, I agree with you on the whole, but and I think what Gatji evoked was the way, at least that's how I read the famous essay on violence and metaphysics mm-hmm. in Writing and Difference, was a way of posing a number of very difficult questions to Levinas from the start, reiterating the point that one cannot go beyond the language of metaphysics. Mm-hmm. And maybe because of this, one could say, critical in a Kantian sense, a Kantian question, how can you go beyond that language you are using when you talk about ethics? You are using the Greek of philosophy and so on. It's a well-known argument and it's a famous text. But I think maybe because of that, then he could, over the years, mm-hmm. Absorb more and more and become more and more part of the Levinasian text
right.
that,
right.
meanwhile, was also taking Derrida into its stride and trying to counter a number of these issues, but in a way, and this is something we evoked together and Barnard when there was this homage to Derrida, I was struck by the fact in which, as some of you may know, he also complicated the legacy of his archive very recently, which seemed to be, after all, one way for Derrida to die and to allow for an easy mourning would be to turn himself into a mausoleum, like Lenin's tomb that you could visit and be in line and see the archive. As some of you may know, just because of a complicated politics at Irvine, Derrida sided with one colleague and then fought with the administration and made access to his own archive extremely difficult, to the point that now it could even be closed. So I think this is quite typical as a gesture, in order not to just say, well, I will die soon, you can have access to my textual body, it's there to be visited. And no, mm-hmm. it's not really to be visited. I'm saying this thinking of Aaron's film, because even though Aaron didn't know about this when he made his film, what one sees in the film is the archive of a sort of dilapidated institution. I think any institution revisited by Derrida leads to that.
Ruins. I mean, that's, I don't know how much longer we have, but I do want to invoke Benjamin slightly here.
Yes.
And the idea of ruins. You know, that's so much in Derrida, so that as we talk about how to mourn, how to, what is his legacy, and so on, I don't quite know how to integrate the notion of ruins into, or does one ever integrate the idea of ruins? These are questions that Derrida taught us to ask. He was a very literal-minded man. This is where De Man and Derrida were friends. I mean, they were both. Diman was my teacher. Before that, I always mentioned Tariq Nasreddin, who was also a literalist from whom I received my first education in reading in Calcutta, and I sort of moved into this because Derrida was so pugnacious in his literal mindedness. He really went at a thing and went to the bottom of it in that sense. And it seems to me that question, the question of becoming someone else, and I completely agree with Eduardo already. Akbar Abbas gave it a name as I was going on about this again and again and endlessly in Taiwan. From the audience, he raised his hand and he said, Gachi, I think what you're saying is that this is in the 80s, that from Derrida what you have learned is to substitute critical intimacy for critical distance. And I said, well, if you don't mind, I will use that phrase and I will not cite you, because I will use it so often that to give a footnote would be ridiculous. But at any rate, already in the ear of the other, the idea of not excusing someone, you know, as Levinas, as Nietzsche, as, you know, Plato, talking about Plato in Voyou, how is Plato getting around the problem of democracy, the question that puts Derrida on a wheel, and I cannot utter this question now, because if I utter this question now, then I will not be able to give my talk on democracy, and so on. And finally, in the middle of the book, he utters the question. It's very serious. And what is the question? If I'm going to talk about democracy, is it not true that whatever I'm saying should be available and accessible, not to just kind of the envious half-educated academic whining away, but to quiconque, to anyone, because that's what democracy is about. And so looking at Plato, is that Plato solves the problem by making the archons above the law. Aristotle solves the problem, he reads exquisitely. Aristotle solves the problem by dwelling ultimately on the merit versus numbers problem and saying this can't be solved, and so on and so forth, okay? So he's not excusing anyone. If Nietzsche wrote this and the Nazis picked it up, that means it was there. But then he says, do not accuse. Enter the protocols. That's what, and you know, I sometimes to my students, I say, listen, protocols is not like entering the argument. I mean, you know, in front of the queen, you back out and you courtesy, etc. Those are not reasonable things. It's the protocol of the occasion. So, and then entering the protocols, you find where the moklas is, you turn it around, and you use it. You use it. So that, in a sense, that way of dealing with whoever it is, it seems like the person becomes the text in that sense. And that is the aura of that era. Jean-Michel. I'm not nostalgic for it, but I remember very, very clearly the extraordinary excitement. I had become assistant professor the year before, it dates me, in 1966 when Barthes' thing came out in Communication. It was an unbelievable kind of thing. That was where we began to see that the business of reading was indeed to enter the protocols, and Barthes and Derrida didn't share a great deal. But this, I believe, did inhabit. I mean, Lacan, in his own way, reads, you know, Actaeon and the Hounds or Antigone, in this, which is why quite often we're not satisfied with his reading, because it's not like what we more conventionally think of reading, establishing an interpretation on a kind of legal model. That's not what we're doing. So therefore, we take refuge in saying he became the text. But it is, in fact, a reading.
I mean, I would just emphasize your evocation of Benjamin, who I think is somebody who's extremely important to the discussion that we're having, especially in terms of trying to think about the relationship between politics and mourning, and not only in the Trauerspiel book, in the book on the mourning play, but also in the thesis on the concept of history, which could be read, in fact, as a treatise on the ethics and politics of mourning. And I think that to the extent that those theses and much of his work tries to induce a kind of tension between the past and the present, or between the dead and the living, there's a way in which to mourn the past, to have this engagement, this ongoing struggle with the past, is to establish a kind of active and open relation to history. And I think that that this ongoing active relation to history is what enables not only the rewriting of the past, but a reimagining of the future. And I think that that's something that would be very important to return to. And also, Benjamin is Mr. Ruins, right? I mean, there's a way in which he and, I mean, Derrida evokes Benjamin in the memoirs of the blind text when he's talking about ruins, in fact. And of course, there's this very beautiful passage in Memoirs of the Blind where at one point he Derrida imagines or talks about how he has always wanted to write a treatise on the relationship between love and ruins. And of course, one of the things that one could say is that one can always only love ruins because one can always only love things that are mortal. Right, things we can only love what's finite, and so I think that there is a way in which you can bridge or link even this little routine or thread of ruins, finitude, relations, and so on to much of what we said earlier.
Right. Maybe in order not to conclude, because you know, as Flaubert said, it's always silly to conclude. We could open. I think we can take. Can we take 10 minutes to take questions? Because I know that a number among you wanted to say something. So we could just limiting ourselves to 10 minutes before screening the film. Anybody wants to react to anything said by Gayatri or Eduardo? Or me?
Actually, one thing that I'll while we're waiting for responses, one thing that I'll just evoke is in a recent book, Judy Butler, in Precarious Life, which is a book very much about the relationship between politics and mourning, at a certain point she talks about the hierarchy of grief and mourning. I mean, she evokes something like the hierarchy of grief and mourning. It's in the context of the way in which within the media, within political discourse, certain people seem to have more of a right to mourn than others, right? Or that some lives seem more grievable than others. And she raises this issue in the context of you know, reminding everyone of all the obituaries that we saw in Manhattan and sort of singularizing every death, providing a narrative for each person, and in the context of suggesting that we rarely, if ever, see obituaries for individual Palestinians, Afghanis, Iraqis, and that there seems to be some kind of hierarchy in relation to who is able to mourn, what lives are mournable and which ones are not, and if you perceive or you conceive of a life as not being a life in the first place, as not being worth a life, then how could you possibly mourn it? And this, I just wanted to bring that up as something that also touches on some of the things that we're talking about.
It's your longest tears.
Yes, something like that.
Yeah. Yes.
At the beginning, there was use of this the phrase finite.
I think, Eduardo, you should say something, because whenever I have thought about the infinite in the context of Derrida, I have changed the word to indefinite. So mm-hmm. I think it would be hard for me. My take on Derrida is somewhat harsher, I think. I think you should perhaps address this issue, but I have said what I have to say. Carry on.
Well, I mean, I will invite you when I'm done to say why you make that transposition.
Yes.
Between infinite and finite. But I guess I mean, what most quickly comes to mind is the very early essay, Structure, Sign, and Play, in which he's talking about the way in which a structure opens onto a kind of infinity. And what he says there is that the reason it opens onto a kind of infinity is because it doesn't have a center, or it doesn't have a fixed ground around which it can settle itself. And that's what opens, at least in that context, opens up the structure to a kind of relation to infinity. I actually use the phrase finite transcendence, not finite infinity, but it was in response to what Gautry was saying. It just is a kind of, not really a correction, just a retranslation.
Doesn't he say in that early essay, I'm sorry, I don't mm-hmm. want to go on into he said, she said, but yeah. Doesn't he say that the structuralists think that the structure hasn't a center?
That the structuralists think.
Huh. Isn't that what it's about? And then it turns out that there is this kind of language stuff, etc. Anyway, we'll have to read it again. Yes, and what I was saying, of course, was not the transcendence. I was saying the intuition of the transcendental, which, again, is a bit harsher. You know what I mean? More questions.
Maybe to add something to this great question to try and answer, because I think, indeed, infinite as a concept is something that belongs more to Levinas than to Derrida. But you can see in Derrida the very recurrent use of infinitely as an adverb. Mm. So the infinitely thanking, for instance, to be infinitely grateful.
Yes.
And I think that fits very well with what Gautry mm-hmm. was saying. That so it's not the infinite that is present in the other face mm-hmm. that would be out there, as it were, but an infinite task that leads us to the future and yes. therefore to a sort of indefinite that is also yes. infinite. But I'm struck by this, the adverb, and infiniment in French, that is often mm-hmm. used in order to suggest something that is complex, indefinitely enmeshed, and so on.
It's the mise en abîme, eh? I mean, it's not really the end. Insofar as Levinas's early interest in infinity, reminding us of the need to remember the infinite, as it were, when we want to totalize a system, insofar that particular instinct was shared by Derrida, except it's what it opens up into is like it's not a beyond, but it's mm-hmm. a pas au-delà,
exactly.
Which is, I'm reading Freud's Legacy again because I'm writing this legacy thing for PML, as you say. Mm-hmm. And it's very interesting to see how he's looking at Freud and saying that he's not doing mm-hmm. what mm-hmm. every French Freud enthusiast thinks he's doing. Precisely from this point of view,
that
it's not a beyond.
Absolutely.
But
and it's also a grammatical transformation, a little like what Heidegger does with Hegel, saying replacing the absolute by thinking absolutely, or the infinite, thinking infinitely.
It's the change between the adverb and the noun there that's kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. And as you mentioned to Butler, I was at a conference with Derrida, Judith Butler, and in Irvine, California, I think about 2001 or so, and it was exactly the week that Jean-François Léotard had died, and there was an attempt within the conference to speak about Léotard, and whereas Derrida was there to speak, and he had known Léotard very well, I thought it was quite interesting, he refused to speak, mm-hmm. so he refused to tell, to impose an idea of Léotard on the conference. And in fact, he just went on to several anecdotes, which he so rapidly sped up the audience and sat down in a very abrupt way. And I thought that was quite interesting because as you speak of transcendence and you speak of infinite, and as you speak of moving from the noun version to the adverbial part of it, and as you speak of the idea of rooms, it seems that there's implicit in all of that is a sense of great resistance to any type of narrative and any type of quick
even beyond an anecdote, of a coupling of pieces together that makes something nameable as Derrida, that we're so inhabited within that realm as to not want to name, not want to speak a tale of Derrida, a pieces of Derrida. And I wonder how much that will work on us, because the business of mourning, it seems to me, finally does result in that idea of a narration that's necessarily forces itself back out. And this very powerful figure who resists and transforms and plays with narrative in and out of itself does not want that to happen, it seems to me. And that is part of the legacy that we're all, in some ways, responding to, which, contrarily to mentioning the first business chat, the others who speak of Derrida have no problem imposing narrative right away, very, very quickly.
But you would agree, wouldn't you? That's a very, very interesting intervention. You would agree, wouldn't you, that mourning is taking place?
Okay, sure.
You know,
it's in your word, it's performatively. In your word, quite it is the performance under which we are going through, which is also not capturable in the pan-narrativistic way.
And the performative conventions of mourning, again, I'm citing Derrida, the event of mourning is what escapes those conventions. And so, but don't you think that we relate to some people, it's not like it's an ontophenomenological characteristic of Jacques Derrida, but mourning is after all a problem of relation rather than a problem of knowing or defining. We relate to some people in such a way that the possibility of mourning seems always postponed as mourning takes place.
Yes, but you also invoke the sense of a kind of cultural practices, and this is an unusual cultural practice in the terms of a way of mourning, is just to keep speaking about it as well. So yes, we are participants in that, but it also is in its way a kind of public and quite undefinable text that we're invoking here. I'm a performance theorist, so
I mean, there's a very beautiful moment in the text that he wrote after the death of de Man in Memoirs, where in talking about the goddess Mnemosyne and memory and talking about Holden in an impossible morning, at one point he confesses that he has never known how to tell a story. And I think there is this very nice way in which that line not only has some relation to Benjamin's own resistance to narrative, but in the little anecdote that you tell, there is a way in which in resisting telling a story, in resisting providing a narrative about Lyotard, etc., there's a way in which he, as you say, performs an homage to one of the great analysts of and resistors of the grand narrative, right? And so there's a way in which he does that, too.
John, two questions.
Come back to the first issue at the very beginning of all of this about mourning and melancholia. And I know that Derrida was in many places made this distinction very problematic in relation to psychoanalysis generally, but one of the difficulties I have when he talks about psychoanalysis always is that from a sort of practical point of view, stubborn, pragmatic, obvious point of view, maybe a clinical point of view, there is a difference between mourning and melancholia. At least if you look back to Freud's text, it's pretty clear that melancholia is a really profoundly debilitating state. It's a state in which you cannot write, you cannot get out of bed, you don't know how to go on with life at all. And even if we don't know what mourning is, even if we don't know how to mourn, and we don't know if we're mourning, we are here and we're speaking, we are, to a certain extent, alive here, and it's not the same as melancholia, as Freud describes it in that text. And so, philosophically speaking, I'm always convinced that Derrida is right. But clinically speaking, there is a difference between mourning and melancholia.
See, I'm sorry, carry on. But that's the madness of reasonable practice. You know, whenever Derrida comes in to that part of Freud, he says, I'm not responsible in psychoanalysis, that's in geopsychoanalyse. Or he would say, I've never been an analyse, etc. So I cannot, I'm sorry I interrupted you, but it just came out like that. It's in the, so it's, he does not in fact confront that question of the clinical healing of the melancholic. That is not like being melancholy, no. And also, that's, he does not go in there except once or twice, but that's somewhere else when he's talking about Nicolas Abraham and Maria Torok, and he says, Demi-deuil, so they're talking about the Wolfman. And there he says that even, and Freud would not disagree with that one, you know, but the calculus of clinical practice, the reasonable calculus of psychoanalysis, Vaida always kept his distance from that one. I'm glad you brought that up.
I don't say to reassert the authority of a kind of diagnostic paradigm or anything like that. I say it, I think, because what's really on my mind is I was struck partly by the same question when Eduardo was talking about reading, about what reading means and the practice of reading, which I think we do everywhere in the world, in the academy perhaps above all, so badly. This is something that Derrida taught us. And it strikes me that maybe the distinction between mourning and melancholia could be useful in relation to the legacy of Derrida, in the sense that, or perhaps even politically, in the sense that how we manage to receive and carry on differently in many different ways what it was that he gave us would require that we not become incapacitated. That's where I think that there's some usefulness to the distinction between mourning and melancholia, that we mourn and that we not fall into melancholia. And I think there really would be a difference there for what happens next, or what happens next with him.
Although, I appreciate your comment. I mean, one of the things that one could say too, though, is that if we had a better understanding of the pathology of melancholy, that it might be able to become a resource for us politically, right? So that even in Freud's initial conception of melancholy, right, this ongoing struggle to negotiate and come to terms with the past, which never seems to work, and so this devotion to the lost object, this inability to overcome the loss, and so on. One of the things that you can say is that ongoing, continuous struggle with the past is a way of actively engaging the past, you know, so that it also has to do with, it presumes that the fact that the past is not fixed, that it's not complete, and there's a way in which it at least allows for the possibility of an ongoing and open relation to the past. And it seems to me that might be a resource rather than a difficulty, if one is.
And not to become incapacitated after a death applies to all deaths.
Yes.
So to an extent, I mean, we must be able generally to mourn. Speaking within these conventions about Jacques Derrida, of course, that bottom line is always true. We must behave in a healthy way towards the recently dead. But that's trivially true to an extent, if you will allow me to make that remark. What we are talking about here is not that, but having said that, what then? As you said yourself, that philosophically you're sure that Derrida is right. And to an extent, that's what we are talking about, it seems to me. I don't.
Because then that becomes the point of departure, right? Rather than, I mean, one begins with that.
I think you had one question.
Thanks. 20 years ago, Derrida spoke at the University of Toronto. The text upon which he reflected was a newly discovered letter by Gershom Scholem about the sacred in language.
It is the volcano passage, right?
It was a grand example of Derrida surrendering to the language of don't know. Did Derrida maintain an interest in either Scholem or in the sacred in language? And if so, is that at all relevant to us mourning him?
Do you know where the Benjamin?
I think the interest in Scholem is probably mediated by the interest in Benjamin. I don't think there is anything very specific. Derrida's relationship to language has always been a difficult one. Right from the start, I hope nobody disagrees with this too violently. Right from the start, he looked at language as having, as dangerous as it is powerful, as providing a solution to all kinds of problems. Structure, sign, and play is indeed a problem because in the center then comes language without a cause, but it becomes an effect without a cause, and it becomes a cause without a cause, and so on and so forth. It seems to me that Derrida was perhaps failing, but nonetheless trying all his life to substitute the trace and the mark for signifying systems. Because the trace is unverifiable and yet seems to point at some other thing. And the mark becomes, mark loses its significance. And it seems to me that that's something that we don't want to attend to, because we too are mesmerized by the power of language to solve most questions. I think Derrida is, again, maybe I'm being too harsh, but I think language does not come first for Derrida, no. Mm-hmm. Coming first and sacred are not the same thing, I realize that, but sacred would take us into such mysterious thickets that it cannot be. I do have many things to say about that, but right or wrong, but I don't think that can be a last question. So next time.
Well, thank you very much. I think we'll stop here for the moment. Will you all cordially invited to drinks afterwards? Just have a 20-minute screening filmed by Aaron Levy that has something to do with what we were discussing, and then we can go on with questions and answers.
Thank you very much for coming, all of you.
Thank you.